Hello and welcome to the Mindful World Summit. I'm Dr. Stacy, and I'm so excited for this interview with Annie Lala and Eben Pagan, who are both teachers and coaches. We're passionate about helping people reach their potential, find love, and live really fulfilling lives. They met at Burning Man in 2009 and are now married and have a five-year-old daughter named Love. So lovely. They are staying together for the rest of their lives. They're fully committed, and they're committed to helping other people as well. Really play the most intense game there is, as they would define it, the game of love. Welcome, Annie and Eben, to the summit.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
We're so glad to have you. And as I was mentioning before we started recording today, you're the only actual couple that we have on the summit. So and you're so dedicated, each of you, to your own growth and to the development of your relationships between each other and your family. So we're so interested in hearing about your wisdom. So, you know, maybe we can talk at the beginning about how you actually view your roles as parents.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a stab. I see myself as a gardener. I see the child as a seed, and it's got its own intelligence to grow into its actualized future potential. And my job is to make sure it's watered, to get sunlight, and pretty much stay out of the way and keep it alive, but let it unfurl to its final magnificence. And I trust that magnificence is lurking latent in my child's developing mind and heart and self. And so I'm a shepherd, gardener. That's more of my frame on it.
Okay. Do you both agree on that, Eben?
That's a good one. I'll add to that. I see myself as basically a nurturer and a tour guide to reality.
Okay. Tell me about the tour guide part.
Well, reality is this very interesting place, and there's a lot going on here. And some of it works the way that, you know, you would think that it would, but a lot of it doesn't. And a lot of things that you have to, you know, you have to learn and you have to try and you have to have these experiences to help you develop. And so I see myself as a bit of a tour guide, showing my child around and showing them what's going on here in reality.
And what's cool about it.
Yeah, what's cool about it, how, you know, how it works, what to do if things don't go the way that you want them to, you know, how to take what's in your mind and make it real out here in this reality. Yeah, so I'll have a tour guide to reality.
Okay, because you've been here a little longer. Yeah. You kind of know how this physical plane works. And so, but it sounds like there's certainly a level of involvement, but also a real respect to not intervene too much, it sounds like.
I see also my child as an extraordinary tour guide to realities that I didn't map. And so I think we both know it goes both ways. And I think intervening to keep our daughter alive, but trying to be aware that where the intervention is more about me imposing something that my values, rather than letting her unfurl organically into who she wants to be. Okay. And allowing her to figure it out.
Okay. So that sounds like it requires quite a bit of awareness and self-control, right?
Self-control?
Like terms of just not, you know, because we have our reactivities and, you know, things that are maybe hard for us and it feels like our reality or is their reality, but maybe it's not.
Oh, I'm clear that ours is not her reality, okay. Not their reality, but okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, every one of our parents and ancestors survived to adulthood and found a mate and had a child and raised that child to adulthood, or at least the child survived to adulthood, all the way back for a long, long, long ways, depending on what you're spiritual or religious or, you know, millions of generations or billions, you know. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember that this is a human being here. Like, this is a resilient, spectacular manifestation. That you've got this miraculous thing that comes pretty well equipped to deal with life and to grow up and to actualize and to manifest its potentials. And you know, when you, I think when you look at it that way, when you kind of have reference for the miracle that you were born and that your child was born and
through all those selective pressures.
And
I think relating to the child, like they're a miracle and not forgetting. We do when they're born, every spirit goes, this is a miracle, but to keep that native every day when my daughter walks in the room to say goodbye, to go on her adventures, I try to presence myself to the miracle. I mean, we regularly talk about her as this moving and unfurling miracle.
So really, you might use the term reverence, and just we lose sight of it. I think because I don't know, there's so many of us around. It seems like there's so many of us, but when we really think about it, like each person is a walking miracle, as you talk about, right?
Yeah, and I think the limit to our ability to have reverence for our children is governed by our own ability to have reverence for our own life, our own self. It's a generational issue that gets passed on. It's almost like you're not allowed to have more reverence than your parents did for themselves or their lives, unless you get meta to the pattern and realize, oh, okay, if my parents did a good job, then I necessarily will have gone beyond them in terms of intelligence, success, consciousness. And as a child, to realize, oh, I'm the cutting edge avatar of my lineage. And for us as parents to realize that if we treat her as expecting that she will go beyond us. And in some way, she's already gone beyond me. She can out-negotiate me right now at 5. I've been pointed out regularly. But there's other places where her intelligence or her quickness or her cognitive abilities will go beyond mine. And there's a process that a parent has to go through. It's a kind of delight, envy, bittersweet thing of, she's going beyond me and she won't leave me there anymore. And I'm being superseded, and yay, that means I did a good job. And no one had to deal with that as a parent, so I think an important skill.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I haven't heard someone talk about it that way in terms of that is the task is to ensure. I mean, I think there's this idea that, yeah, you know what, we want more for our kids than we had for ourselves. But then we get, I think, caught up in...
I want more for my kids than I had for myself. I want her to have as much as she can in terms of her actualizing her potential. I don't want it even relevant to me. I want it relevant to where she could go, because that's already right. Like more than me, this much more.
Right. But it's just interesting that I mean, even that is very different than how we, like the lingo or many of us as parents have been raised with, right? That, and so many people are caught up trying to live up to an image of what the parent wanted for them or the expectations of their culture or the tradition in the family of everyone does this. Like we're all lawyers or professionals or, right?
Yeah, I have this image in my mind of a child growing up like a bonsai tree. Mm-hmm. And bonsai trees, the Japanese art of binding trees, they're actually real giant trees that they bind with wire when they're very young and it stunts their growth. Okay. And I think of children's spirits or energies as like these trees that could grow up to be sequoias. And depending about how conscious your parenting is, you can unwittingly bind your children's ability to fully actualize and express and into their highest potential by not tracking where your envy or your upper limits or your fear of being superseded or all kinds of things that get in the way of your child's organic unfurling.
Mm-hmm. That's a great analogy. Great analogy. So it does. It sounds like, you know, this process, though, the way you're approaching parenting is really about awareness of your own growth and potential. Like you need to have to value that.
Yeah. I mean, we're here to cross train each other. He's an extraordinary father. And I'm clear that being a mother is the most important role I'll ever play in my life. It's being his wife. And there are many ways in which he has superpowers in parenting that I don't have. Like he's much better at holding boundaries and not enabling our daughter's smallness. Whereas I'm like a little more helping her out prematurely or responding before she could do it herself, like letting her cope longer. So that's one of the things we're cross-training. He's constantly telling me how to like wait till she asks for help the second time, not the first time. And I can't remember how to answer the question, but basically we're here to cross train each other and upgrade each other's parenting. I see my My job is to watch where he's falling short of the kind of father he'd want to be. He can't see the blind spot, and then doing the best I can to compassionately reflect that so that he could live up into that greatness. And then I really welcome that. I mean, sometimes it's hard to hear, but I really try to take note when my husband gives me reflection around how I could mother at the at another level higher of consciousness and get that that's a gift he's giving me rather than a complaint.
Wow, that's a really beautiful way of seeing that dynamic, because it's such a bone of contention between parents is the differences in how they approach people. They get so stuck into their way. It's like, well, this is the way I was raised. Right? It was good enough for me. Like, you know, there's a whole lot of, but there's none of that with you guys. There's no attachment to that. And it's more focused on where do we want to go and how can I support you?
Yeah. Also keep in mind that we're on video right now. And, you know,
you're not in our living room when we're triggered.
Yeah. And we also teach a lot. And so we make it sound like we've got it all together. But just to get the reality here, just so everybody knows what page we're really on, we argue a lot.
We lose our shit.
We are not, you know.
That, you asked us for the philosophy, right?
Yeah.
Now you ask us what's happening on a Wednesday at 4. Might be a different story.
But. Yeah. Okay. We argue a lot. We have a lot of issues, and we've got a lot of neurotic crazies that both of us have. And really. But we're also really, really trying. You know, really trying. And what we're here to communicate is the best of what we've learned, not necessarily to make it sound like this is the way that it is all the time around us.
Right.
If you catch us, you know, like she said, on a random Wednesday, you know, maybe we've kind of got this woven into things, and you can kind of see the way things are. Mm-hmm. I wanna make a comment on what you said there about this is the way I was raised.
Yeah.
Because this is right down at the heart of the matter in a lot of ways, okay? So we, when Annie and I are out in public or, you know, just kind of going about our lives, we're always watching how other people parent their children. And unfortunately, it's very disheartening, and it makes us very sad when we watch most people, you know, interacting with their children in different ways, because there are often things going on that if the parent knew, like if they could just know what was actually happening, what the experience was for the child in that moment, we feel like they would just snap out of it, and you know they would behave in a completely different way. But they can't see themselves, and in a lot of cases, this comes down. It really does come down to the way that they were parented. Most of us don't realize that, you know, yes, we were born this miracle, this spectacular manifestation of life, of creativity, of development, of, you know, we've got these nested brains and we have this ability to learn and communicate, use technology and all this kind of stuff. But also, just like young animals, as we're growing up, we take imprints and then we use those as our reference structures for the rest of our lives. And the experiences that we had with our parents, and because things are accelerating and they're moving so fast, we all live in this reality. We look back at our parents and we don't really take into consideration the generation gap and how things have accelerated and what a different life it was for them. I mean, a lot of them, you know, grew up or were raising kids using like Dr. Spock methods or these other, you know, these things that are looked at as being kind of archaic now, or even like, you know, caveman, you know, level stuff. And when it really comes down to asking people about, you know, why you're shaming your child or why you're incentivizing your child or why you're punishing them or why you're rewarding them or why you're
teaching
doing
manners.
These things. Yeah, exactly. Or teaching manners or teaching them to be polite or to be nice to others or
say thank you.
Yeah, all please and thank you. All that stuff, because, you know, we've got a 5-year-old. She's going to turn 6 soon. And when people try to do that and teach that stuff to our daughter, I'm always asking them, like, okay, so why are you doing that? Why are you teaching her that? Not in an accusing way, but like trying to get down to it. And, you know, their answers will often be things like, well, she's going to need to learn to be polite because that's how you get along in the world. Or she's going to need to learn to be, you know, friendly because this or that. No, that's just being respectful. Or there are all these reasons. But then I keep going and I say, well, let's talk about developmental psychology for a minute. At what level should you teach morals to a child? At what level do you actually believe that a child can understand the idea of politeness and what it even means to the other person?
Or
understand that the other person has another perspective than their own. That doesn't come on until four anyway.
And so the bottom line is, at the bottom of all of these, every time I've had this conversation to the person, at the end is, well, that's the way I was raised. Okay, so my little secret belief that I'll share here, mm-hmm. I'm no super parenting expert or anything, but I've been studying this and kind of asking questions. My secret belief is that most people are trying to teach their child to be nice, polite, or to be good, or more, they're trying to teach morals to the child at an age that's too young. They're trying to teach adult ways of thinking that it would be kind of like trying to teach a one-year-old math, you know, and thinking that because when you say what's 1 + 1, because they hold up two fingers, thinking that they understand math when actually it was just because you yelled at them enough that they learned, you want me to go like this when you say what's 1 + 1.
Right.
It isn't because they get it. And I think that trying to teach children things before they're ready to actually understand it is counterproductive in the long term, because it just builds neurotic adults.
Well, it also teaches them to do it for reasons other than their own endogenous, understood reasons. They're doing it to get approval or avoid disapproval. And, you know, we have a pretty strong belief that using discipline and punishment and in rewards and incentivization are ultimately counterproductive for the child's own self-esteem, development in the future. You can tell a story about how kids rewarded end up being demotivated in something they were originally motivated for if they're externally motivated. And,
And it's exactly what you're talking about. Some other experts on this summit, I'm recalling Dr. Laura Markham from AHA Parenting shared some of that data as well, about how even just really paying attention to the sharing behavior makes it less likely to happen organically on its own.
Exactly. Oh, that's so nice that you just shared that with the other person. It's like, No, leave them alone. Just let them do it. It's like putting a mustache on the Mona Lisa or something. Like, just let it happen.
I wanted to make sure we talked about, we actually have taught relationship skills and we taught a lot on conflict resolution in couples. And we've noticed that being able to explore our conflicts in real time in front of our daughter or in the family system is something that's different than other parents, and we actually think it's important to be able to fight in front of your kids because you're fighting anyway, and having the kids see what the fight looks like, and it also forces you to fight in a way that you would want to prescribe for your child, which is what happens when they're watching, and have them watch the resolution process happen in real time so they don't go away thinking, oh, conflict happened, Mom and Dad disappeared, and we have no clue what happened after that. And it makes them conflict avoidant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I follow on that?
Yes, please do.
As a takeaway here, something to actually do, one of the most important things that we've ever learned about parenting, we got from one of our mentors and coaches, Cecily Miller. And she taught us something that is just so extraordinary. And it looks like this. So so for the first couple of years, if Annie and I would start bickering or, arguing about something, our daughter didn't seem to care. She would just kind of be going on about what she was doing. But then maybe at like 3 or something, we noticed as we're starting to argue, all of a sudden she's just looking right at us, like totally transfixed at what's going on here. And that was like a little awakening moment. But Cecily had taught us about this, and we had been practicing this a bit. And so what we do is if we start arguing and it starts to get serious, like we can tell this is going to be one of these, real ones.
Yeah,
one
being of us, triggered or escalating in any way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of us will turn to our daughter and we'll say, honey, Mom and Dad are having an argument right now. We're upset with each other and we're having a fight.
But sometimes they say we're having intense feelings.
We're having intense feelings towards each other. And we can say, but I just want you to know that this isn't about you. We're not upset with you. And there isn't anything that you have to do right now. We've got it. We're going to handle this between us. Yeah. Okay.
And I usually say we love each other and we're going to work it out.
So amazing.
That's not a risk.
And so we've had that one wired in since very early.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is that we've had fights where we'll start arguing and it'll be getting pretty intense. And one of us always remembers, right? One of us will forget and the other one will remember. So it's probably about 50-50 that we tell her this when it starts happening. Mm-hmm. And we had one, I don't know, this might've been like maybe 6 or 12 months ago where we started getting into, we were arguing and it was getting serious. And I said to my daughter, you know, I said, hey, we're having a fight right now. You know, this isn't about you. You know, we're gonna work this out. You don't have to do anything. And I could see she was a little upset. And she came over and she hugged me. And she needed a hug and she was hugging me. And I said to her, I was like, are you okay, honey? And she's like, yeah, I'm okay, Dad. Just need a hug. And I said, okay, is it okay if we keep going? She's like, yep. And so I'm hugging her.
Wow.
While we're in our argument. And then she kind of got up at, you know, and walked away at some point. But it's, she knows now when we're having an argument that this is not about her and that there isn't anything that she has to do. And I'll tell you what, as a parent, I mean, I didn't know that. I grew up with my parents fighting and violence. And like, I grew up in a really intense environment. Mm-hmm. And when people get into conflict around me, I unconsciously get really nervous. Like, I've got to do something. This is, even if it has nothing to do with me, but it's deep, you know? And I'm proud that of all the things that this one, that she knows to let us have our own thing. And so
not just resolve. We're very transparent about when we complete a resolution, when we make up and we're huggy and we let her know. Mm-hmm. We figured it out. So she sees a continuance.
Arc, yes.
When something happens, it gets resolved so that she gets the conflicts get resolved.
Yeah.
We love each other.
Yes, absolutely. That's, I mean, it's really so different from what I think society for the most part condones or promotes in terms of like you need to shield your children from all of that. But yeah. if we have a home environment where emotions are part of it, that we're emotional creatures, it's part of our how we operate, and we need to figure this out, and this is how we work it out. Yeah. And so it's wonderful.
Feelings, you know, mom's feeling very angry now, I'm frustrated, I'm sad. Exactly. Gives her permission to have her feelings and know that they're okay. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And real resiliency. I mean, as you were talking about, you know, the fight or flight response that happens for you because you're around conflict, you know, but you've clearly developed enough to be able to stay in it. Right. And I assume that's even from your own work in order to not just escape or, you know, put up too much of a wall that this becomes a sticking point that doesn't get resolved.
Well, we fight a lot.
Yeah, no, not to say that we'll resolve them eventually.
In the middle of it, you wouldn't say that because I get pretty triggered. Okay. I'm, you know, my childhood is definitely with me. I don't want to make, we're not like hitting each other.
We're not violent.
But we argue pretty intensely about things. Mm-hmm. And I'm not all the time, but I don't know. I just kind of want to. I don't know, again, make it clear, not make it sound like everything's perfect around
here. Well, he's the angry one. I'm the scared, distressed one. So we both kind of have our different roles that we take on in argument.
Yeah, we've got those kind of stereotypical. Okay.
But there's a foundation of trust, and you also have this foundation of, I know you're doing your best, as I heard you say that earlier, right? Like there's this understanding that like there's good intentionality here. Like I this is a safe place that we can hash this out.
And I know we're staying together. There's no break at the end of any fight. So it's just not a matter of whether it works. It's how it's going to work. And let's figure it out. Sometimes you have to tussle to do that. Mm-hmm. So I think, making sure your child sees anger is safe and it gets resolved. Also, I think we should talk about how treating your child with like a dignity. There's a way in which we have a philosophy around how we relate to our child.
Yes.
Having equal dignity to ours, no less. Mm-hmm. She may be younger, she may have less experience, but in my relationship to my daughter, when I look at her, it's, you know, you might be familiar with the term namaste, it comes from India, and it means the divine or the sacred in me greets the sacred in you. Mm-hmm. And when you greet a human, whether they're the president and you're homeless, I feel like namaste is a basic greeting that's important for every human being to have with each other, and in particular between parents and children. And so I always try to stand in this place of, hello, fellow human being, who's a miracle with co-dignity. And then from there, I can still hold a boundary. I can still say no, but it's not with any compromise of status or dignity to the child.
Yes, yeah. real true respect for sure.
You know, when my daughter was born, I have a good friend. His name's Richard, and he came over to our home. She was, I don't know, maybe one and a half or something. Mm-hmm. And he came in, and he's a very successful business guy who's like always wears like nice coats and jackets and just looks the part, and you know, seems really high status and sophisticated. And he walked into the house. And he immediately came right over and got right down on her level, like on his knees. So he's looking eye to eye with her. And he started talking to her and interacting with her. And my respect for him went up so much. And she just loved him. And I was like, there's a person that gets it. There's a human that knows this is another human that you're going to meet eye to eye, human to human. And yeah, you might be further along in a lot of ways, but there's a bond that happens. There's a knowing. It's like, you know, the dog knows if you like it or not. You know, well, the human knows if you are one of these people that, you know.
And humans are, like, kids are lesser quality.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It reminds me of something you had mentioned to me just before we started recording today was your philosophy about raising an adult versus a child. Tell us about that. It sounds like this is related.
Yeah, well, I mean, that you said it, right? We're not raising children here, we're raising adults. And what I try to do, because I make a lot of mistakes as a parent, what I try to do, though, when my daughter's breaking down or she's having a super fussy day or she's just doing something that's annoying me or frustrating me or whatever, is I try to remember in my mind what I'm about to do or what I'm doing is not for this moment. What I'm doing is for when she's 20. For when she's 40, for when she has children. What I'm doing in this moment is I'm trying to get my sight aligned with that long-term vision. And if I can remember that, which I can maybe like 20 or 30% of the time, but if I can remember that, then the way that I respond to her is different, because what I am remembering is that she's going to be an adult. And these are the years and the months and the weeks and the days and the moments when she's imprinting what it means to be human. Mm. And half of that fundamental imprint in her consciousness. And what I need to do here is behave in a way so that when she has a child, you know, the old one where, you know, you have a child and then you get upset and then some words come out of your mouth and you're like, that's my mother talking right now. Or like, oh my God, that was my dad. And I even heard his voice. It was in his tone. And you all have had that experience. Mm-hmm. Try to remember to whatever you're doing, even if you're upset, that when it comes out of her mouth, when she's an adult and she goes, that's my dad speaking. You want her to be like, that's my dad talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so if you can remember you're raising an adult and what you're doing here is making an imprint of what adults should do, it helps, I think, a lot.
Yeah. And I think thinking about it as when I'm interacting with my daughter, especially if I'm in some kind of role where I have to push back, I'm optimizing for two things: for what would serve her in the moment and what would serve her as a 40-year-old grown woman at the same time. If I can interview both, if I'm optimizing for both of those, what I do in this moment will have a higher level of consciousness and utility than if I just optimize for this moment. Okay, here, have the thing you want, even though it's undermining your development of resilience and self-esteem, or you need to cope so that later in life that you can cope with things. They have shadows of each. Mm. You know, if I only optimize for giving my daughter what she needs in the moment, she won't be resilient later in life. If you only optimize for making her learn to cope so she can deal with the reality, the harsh realities of the world, then in the moment, she's not getting the nourishment and support that she needs from her parents. So it's a dance. That I think is optimizing what serves her in this moment and when she's a grown 40-year-old woman.
Okay, so, I mean, you give great examples of the extremes of what we can do to just get through this moment or stand our ground and say, this person needs to be strong enough to resist the candy, I don't know, whatever it is, right? Like, make good, healthy choices, whatever we have conflicts about. But can you give us an example of how you would approach it? Let's say a scenario like that. The child wants to eat a candy for breakfast and you know that they get super hyper if they have sugar. And you
My daughter's not had sugar. She doesn't know what a candy is.
Okay, but just pretend.
We are just We'll tell you, we are crazy. All right. We are a little weird. When you get down to it, you're going to be like, are these guys okay?
These are a little wacky parents.
Anyway. Yeah. So, okay.
This is something that you think is not appropriate for the time. And you definitely have some thoughts about that. And but you're keeping in mind, you know, the 40-year-old down the road.
Yeah. So
how does that change how you actually speak to her or deal with that situation? Can you give us
I'm going to give you we are obviously kind of theoretical. We're pretty abstract thinking folks here. Yeah. But I want to give you a frame or a rule of thumb here, right? The basic rule of thumb is if you are getting upset and you're saying whatever it is that you're saying without being here, like if you've kind of lost it and you've gotten triggered and you're not present
and connected.
Yeah. And doing whatever you're doing intentionally, you're probably doing something that's counterproductive.
Okay.
When you do something that's triggered or out of trigger. So like if the child wants to have sugar for breakfast and they're like, no, I want sugar for breakfast. And you get into like, you're not having sugar for breakfast. You know, you did that yesterday and then you blah, blah, you know, or whatever. There's usually a shaming or a blaming or a critical voice, or there's some kind of
manipulation.
Yeah. Or a manipulation. There's something in there that's trying to communicate to the child, like that you have disapproval along with whatever the point is that you're trying to make. Mm-hmm. And so what people do is they conflate and they mix up, I want to get healthy food into my child's mouth with getting triggered. And then by getting triggered, it makes it so it's less likely to get healthy food into the child's mouth. Or if you do get healthy food into the child's mouth, it's not going to be something that they wanted to do and that they're going to do again tomorrow.
And if it's at the cost of the breach of the connection in that moment.
Yeah, you're losing trust with the child. And then you're like, well, you're not going out with you're not getting your iPad until you eat that breakfast. Right. And then now you're in teaching manipulation and like, anytime if you have to do incentivizing where you're going to get this thing if you do it, or you're not going to get this thing or you don't, or you're only getting dessert if you finish your food. Mm-hmm. If you're there, you've kind of already lost the battle and there's a new tack that needs to happen. Okay. That's kind of the basic, you know, rule.
Yeah.
That you learn as a parent why this whole patience is a virtue thing. Parenthood is where you learn what that means.
Yeah.
Patience is a virtue. One thing to keep in mind with children that's kind of a good thing to remember is that time is very different for them than it is for us.
True.
They can't see like we can. And so if you just are patient for a few minutes and then redirect to something and then be patient for a few more minutes and redirect to another thing and then go start cooking the food or bring them the thing that's healthy and put it down without saying anything while you're having a conversation or while you're reading a story.
Stealth.
Yeah, exactly. It takes a couple of extra minutes, but in 80 or 90% of the cases, if you can just maintain and act like everything's cool and remember that in a few minutes, their emotional wave or their resistance or whatever is probably going to go away, but you've got to put away your own manipulations because if you get into those power struggles with your child, you know, a power struggle with a child is not going anywhere positive. And every time you keep getting into it, you're losing more and more because they're way better than you at adapting. I mean, you know, think about you with your own parents. Like, you figured
out.
You outsmarted them early. Your child is way smarter. They're going to outsmart you fast. And so don't do that manipulation stuff. Stay patient, redirect.
But it's specific, right? You want, like, what do we say to the child? What I'm learning is to hold a boundary, like, no. So it's a no to the banana right now because we're about to have dinner. No to the banana, but yes to you. The energy you're feeling is I love you. Yeah. I'm a no to that thing, but I'm a full-on yes to you, all of you. I'm just saying no to that act. So that because what happens with parents is they say no to the banana, and their voice and their tone is no to you. They've withheld love. It's got a punishing, shamey energy, and what the child feels is they're not loving me right now, which we're secretly not loving them or pretending not to love them so that they do the thing we want, which is a manipulation that ends up costing the child's esteem. So I love you more than I'm angry at all times. That's what a child has to feel. I love you more than I'm angry. You can say it. I'm angry. Mommy's really angry right now. I love you way more than I'm angry. And I really need you to clean this up right now. And if whether you say it or you mean it or you be it, if a child can feel that you love them more than you're angry, your anger will actually affect their behavior and they'll get it done and they'll change. But when you hold hostage your love in order to manipulate them, that builds resent. And that teaches a child that your love is conditional and that you wield it willy-nilly depending on whether they please you or not. And they're not here to please you.
Yeah. Another one I'll put in here, one that's kind of one of our family, it's like a family practice and a family value, is, again, you can hear that we're really serious about don't manipulate, don't threaten, yes, don't reward, don't punish, don't do that stuff, right? There's a more spontaneous,
bride.
Yeah, exactly. There's a more natural way to do things so that everything is more,
organic.
Yeah, more organic all the time, right?
Yeah.
So earlier on with our daughter, we always had this thing. So Annie doesn't like to be tickled. She hates it. She had an uncle or something that used to tickle her when she was young.
It's torture.
Yeah, and she was really actually tortured with it. And I tend to be a more playful, teasy, tickly kind of person, right? Mm-hmm. So that obviously doesn't go totally well here. But my daughter, I could tell, does like this. She likes to play tickle, and we have a game that we play called a wrestly tickle, where we jump on each other, we wrestle, and she squeals. And for whatever reason, I'm the one in her life that gets that thing. She and I, you know, we've got that one going on. Mm-hmm. So Annie would be like, you know, no, she doesn't want you to tickle her anymore, because,
and she'd be like pushing him off with her hand a little bit and saying,
And I would keep going, and I would say, no, she wants to. So we'd go.
And I'm like, you're trespassing her boundaries. She said no, and then he'd stop, and then she'd go, keep going, Daddy, keep going.
Yeah, she'd be like, don't stop, you know? And so anyway, at one point we needed to come up with something so that if she really wanted us to stop doing something, she had something to say.
And
so, we gave her, so we talked it over, and what we came up with in our world is, what works for her is, stop, I'm serious.
Oh.
So she has a phrase that she says called stop, I'm serious. Mm-hmm. And we all as a family know that this is a sacred thing. And she doesn't say it very much, but she does say it maybe every, I don't know, couple of days.
But if she says stop, that doesn't count. Stop, I'm serious is the real one.
But she knows.
Yeah.
So she'll say, no, stop, I'm serious. Whether it's tickling or whether it's
anything else,
something with food or whatever, she'll say, stop, I'm serious. But once she had that, then now we have it. And so now once in a while, if she's doing something that we don't like, or she's being fussy, or she won't do something, we'll say, love bug, stop, I'm serious. And she, because it's been sacred with her, every time, but I'll tell you, maybe 80% of the time, she'll go, oh, okay, this is one of those things in our family.
Right.
And by the way, she told me that. I was frustrated with her one day. She wasn't doing something. Later we made up, and she said, Mom, when you wanted me to stop doing that thing, why didn't you just say, stop, I'm serious? And I had never thought to do it because it was her safe word. I didn't even think to use it for myself. She taught me to say, stop, I'm serious, to her so that she would know when I really needed her to put her socks on or whatever.
Right. Oh, my goodness. But this is where, you know, that respect, like everybody is at the same level in terms of their divinity and their wisdom, and we have the same rules for everyone.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, not only is she sacred, but one of the things we wanted to talk about is when you're raising your child, you're actually raising a future world leader. World leader. And treating them consciously as if they're going to be that. Mm. Often that's limited by the self-esteem of the parents. Well, I'm just a farmer in Oklahoma, so how could I raise a child as a world leader? Every child can be a world leader. And every child deserves a shot at it. And so I don't know if you have any ideas about how parents could hold that frame when they're attracted to their children.
Yeah. So you were talking about the status thing there, right? Like we're all equal here.
Well, but just, you know, like getting down at their level, actually having that full respect. That's what I meant by that.
Yeah, totally. Susan Stifelman has this great distinction about being in charge. Mm-hmm. That you can be in charge without having to be controlling.
Yeah.
Okay. And so some of the time it's appropriate. I don't know what it is. I'm just going to make this up right now, but 20% of the time it's appropriate as a parent to kind of assert leadership and to just start saying like, okay, now we're going to go and do this thing, or it's time to do this, or here's the plan that we have and this is what we're going to do, or, you know, we're not living by the rules that we're supposed to have here.
Right.
So there's like this higher you that get that has to be there too. And sure. I think it's very important to have that distinction so that you're more consciously saying like, okay, this is a moment where we're going to stop playing now for a moment. We're going to stop doing our thing. And now we're going to make a transition and you signal to the child, you know, hey, in a few minutes here, we're going to clean this up and we're going to go on and we're going to go out now because we have to go to the store and go shopping or whatever it is that we do.
Right. Because you have more ability to do that. A child doesn't have ability to do it. And that's your role. You're the tour guide.
Exactly. And this is actually, I think, because I've studied leadership in different dimensions, I think that this is really the way to think about leadership wherever you are in life. Hmm. Whether you're leading a team of people at a business, whether you're leading a philanthropic thing, whether you've got a hobby group that gets together and you're the leader, that most of the time what you're doing is you're working or you're interacting or you're playing or you're creating together. And then sometimes you have to pop kind of out and say, all right, now I'm the one that has the biggest strategic view here. I'm the one that can see the biggest perspective, right? Also known as like being older or having more experience, right? And so now I have to now assert that now it's time for us to go and do something different or I have to redirect or whatever. I think a lot of people, they either, number one, they're too attached to being a leader, so they try to stay in that role all the time and everybody's got to respect them and call them with some title or, you know, whatever. And then that doesn't work because then people don't, in the long run, they kind of lose respect or they don't assert themselves and they get to the point where when they finally do, it's like, you know what, everybody, just stop, you know, or you're going to do this because they have felt uncomfortable being a leader. So you have to kind of practice, being a leader. And I think that just to make a comment about leadership in general, the future is about being able to work in small groups together. Okay, being able to work in those threes, fives, sevens, small groups of like 5 to 7, 10. And what we're going to see in the future, and we're already seeing now in, you know, kind of creative dynamic groups here, is what I would call dynamic leadership, which is when each member of the group knows that they're a leader of something and that when it's time for them to take their role of being a leader, that they assert and they say, okay, everyone,
here's my superpower here, and I'm going to take charge.
Yeah, here's what we're doing. If you work on a small work team, and maybe you've got like an administrative person and a technology person and a design person and maybe a coordinator and whatever, that each of them, you know, the technology person at some point will assert themselves and say, okay, everyone, let me talk about what's going on with the technology. Here's what I need from this person. And then, you know, maybe the next person will be the design person. Then they'll be able to say, okay, here, I'm working on the design. I'd like to get input from everyone. Right. But they can do it from a place where they have leadership in some area because we're all leaders somewhere. And this idea that we're all world leaders, because we're all connected now, in your little world, wherever your part of the world is, you're going to have a bunch of people that are going to be looking at you for that thing.
Yeah.
And so this is very important. And so the way that the child learns it, of course, is to be in an experience with a parent who's doing this. That's how you learn it best. It's not from a book. It's to have actually experienced what it's like to have another human being interacting with you on your level, relating to you, communicating with you in a way that you can understand, where you guys are on the same wavelength. And then when it's appropriate, jumping up to take charge, to be a little bit more of a leader, to direct, but not to do it from everyone has to respect
and
me.
And letting the child lead sometimes. They get to decide what we're going to play for the next hour. It's very important for them to feel like they're leading us, teaching us. I love telling my daughter what I've learned from her.
It's a great point.
Getting your child to teach you things that you actually want. What made you do that? Or understanding their inner world. I want to make sure that we talked about regulation. I just feel like...
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so I think the most important job role as a parent or as a person who loves another human is to, when they're upsetting you, when you're upset in response to their behaviors, to have your primary first line of response to be an internal regulation of your own nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't regulate your nervous system, you're then basically asking the other person, usually your child, to do something, be something to regulate your nervous system, which is where the beginning of parentifying children comes from. Mm-hmm. And every resentment a child has with their parents can be traced back to a moment where the parent stopped being the grown-up, stopped being the adult in the room, who was a grounded, centered, safe place, and became a dysregulated, regressed nervous system that then was asking the child to do or be or change so that they could feel better. And, you know, if I could summarize parenting into one thing, it's your job to regulate your nervous system because your child isn't trained in yours. And when you regulate your nervous system, especially as the mother, you create the field of the family home. When you regulate your nervous system, everybody else can regulate theirs. It's not their job to regulate yours.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm not saying I'm excellent at this. There are many times where I'm dysregulated and my husband has to come up to me and say, "Hey, honey, you breathe and regulate," and he will breathe. And when I can relax, then my daughter relaxes, and the whole system relaxes. And
totally.
So get that that's my job.
Yeah. And it leads to this more peaceful home. Like when we, you know, sometimes the kids are just ringing because they're vibing off of whatever's going on with you. And if you can, rather than focusing there, as you're saying, just like, okay, I've got to change my energy. And we
it's
can
the biggest
facilitate
act of love
something else.
For yeah. your child.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes you feel really effective too. Right? Like when you can get to that place of calm when you were just like, you know, frantic, and then you can catch it, or the kid does something or says, you know, they stop doing what they normally would do. And then you like, you catch it and then you see that.
Oh, and doing it transparently in front of the child. Like if I see my daughter, mom's getting frazzled right now. Just give me a minute. I'm going to breathe. And she watches me go from frazzly chaotic to, okay, I'm back now. What were you saying, love? What do you need? And she watches it in real time that I'm taking responsibility for my state. And I'm teaching to her, this is what adult looks like.
And it's interesting because Annie and I have very different perspectives on a lot of things. And we sound pretty aligned here, but we actually have different ideas about a lot of stuff. And what I've learned, I went through a whole phase. I mean, I grew up in this, you know, kind of crazy childhood where everyone was getting upset and expected other people to regulate them, and where there was a lot of transference of these emotions back and forth. And I went through a phase in my adulthood where I was like reading and listening to a lot of Wayne Dyer and Brian Tracy and like take responsibility for my feelings and no one can make me feel anyway. And I remember I used to listen to Wayne Dyer's audio program, How to Be a No Limit Person. And he talked about how he would stand in front of the mirror every day with his toothbrush. He'd be brushing his teeth and he would be saying to himself, Wayne Dyer, no one is going to take this day from you. No one is going to make you feel, you know, and I was like, yeah, that's great stuff. And, you know, and for a lot of years, I really lived that way where it was like, you can't make me feel bad because no one can make me feel anything. I feel the way I feel. And I was really into it. And I avoided having conflict with my girlfriends. And like, I was like this, you know, kind of robotish kind of person. And then I got married. And then I got married and I realized that when you get into you get into another attachment, like you go back to childhood in a certain way while you're moving forward into another phase of adulthood, and you become very sensitized. I mean, this is a little bit of a brutal metaphor, but, you know, falling in love is, you know, cutting both of your hearts open and then stuffing them together to stop the bleeding. And then they kind of grow and they kind of heal, but you're still sensitive because the wound is always delicate. Okay. So I'm using that like, we all can relate to that. If you have a long relationship. Okay. So with that one, I'm the one that is now more of an advocate for accept how much your family and other people impact and influence your emotions, and accept this idea called co-regulation, which is, it's like the more developed, it's the enlightened view of make me feel bad. It's understanding that we do synchronize and we have all of, you know, we have, I think, 60 or 80 muscles in our face and we have voice tone and all these things where we're signaling and sending emotions back and forth and they spread through groups and they're very powerful. And that self-regulation is not denying that you have feelings, which a lot of people, especially like me, that are more head type people, know about. So anyway, a story came to mind when we were talking here is, a while back, I heard her and our daughter out by the front door getting ready to go out. And there's fussing and crying and screaming and she's getting upset and, you know, doing all the things that are not the stuff we're talking about here, you know. And I heard that and it was annoying me because I don't like loud sounds and it just upsets me when I hear my daughter crying. And I'm like, okay. And I started coming out. And as I'm walking out, I'm like, just remembering, like, I'm the one that's sane here. I'm the one that's not upset. And to just try to do something here to help bring this situation down. Mm-hmm. And I just walked in and I said, all right, everybody, let's have a breath, family. And my daughter was getting upset with her, trying to put her shoe on. I was like, what's going on, honey? And it's like, Dada, my sock is uncomfortable, you know, or whatever. And I was like, all right, come here. Let's figure this out together. And then, you know, I'm like, you breathe. And
he's petting me.
They settled down and got out the door and got on their way. And it was work. Like, it was hard for me to stay present and calm.
And not just yell at everyone, like, shut up.
Sure.
But I tried to, you know, really make it so that their experience was that I wasn't doing any work. Because if you're doing something like this and you're helping them, but you're also saying, like, you guys really suck right now. But I'm going to help
you. You interrupted my call.
Yeah, but I'm going to help you anyway. That isn't it. You know, mm-hmm. So when you're talking about regulation, there's also this helping others regulate without it being like a codependent kind of thing.
Right, right. Is it relatively easier though, if you feel like you have a role to play in this grand scheme, like you don't have to be right in it and you're kind of just there supporting this connection or allowing this to be more of a facilitator of this interaction?
I think so. You know, I feel my conscience is telling me that we have to talk about something we haven't mentioned here, which is
okay.
I are very fortunate. Okay. Life really worked out for us. Things mm-hmm. really worked. I had a very rough childhood and the first, you know, half of my life was a little iffy, but mm-hmm. I, you know, success became important and I studied business for a lot of years. You know, Annie has had a successful life. She got to go to university and have a good career. And we now are successful in our businesses. And so when our daughter was born, we decided that we wanted to keep our lives fully going, like our careers and everything. And so we made the decision. We always have a person that's working with us that helps us with our child.
Mm.
Yeah, and teaches and, you know, and so forth. Yeah, you know,
helps
us to raise her. And I want to say that because it's something that makes us a little less relatable, if that makes sense. It's like we're in a very privileged situation here. Another thing too is we waited until we were 40-ish to have a child and we have one. And so we also waited until the phase of our life where we were a little more grown up and a little bit more mature. I mean, our parents had us when they were like 20.
Teenagers.
And I have no idea how we survived. I don't know. I mean, and now when I look back, there's a part of me that goes like, how did they do so well? You know, I used to think that they were kind of crazy and so forth. And so there are a lot of, I don't know. I just want to make sure that, because I know we kind of come across sounding like we've got everything together, but we've got a lot of benefits that I think are important for everyone to know about.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. And I think that's important. And at the end of the day, we're talking about resources, right? In that we have resources outside of us, resources within us. And it's the awareness of the resources, the potential that we all have, and that we can learn it, right? Like, so we land where we land. Some of us are luckier than others. But we have the possibility, if we have the awareness, then we can practice, we can define these tools and we can make a change. And so I appreciate your sensitivity to that because this is why this is a free online summit, because we want to democratize mental health. I'm interested in getting rid of my role as a psychologist, believe it or not. I would love to eliminate the need for me and just be focused on, okay, let's be better and better and better and better and strive and design your life, right?
Yeah.
But it is what it is. And so if enough of us are on board with really, and honestly, I feel everything that you're talking about is really about deep respect, what I call deep respect, the namaste of life, right? Like really embodying that understanding. And it allows for so much patience and love to really inform everything. And from what you're describing, it's messy. It's, you know, there's heartbreak in there, right? Like this is work. And it takes so much self-awareness and self-growth. But in the end, everyone is growing and becoming more resilient together. That's the picture that I see. And I think that's something that's open and available to all of us, even people that are in harder circumstances. And maybe my hope is that if we can all be in this mode with, and the people who have more resources, even having sometimes maybe even more responsibility to be right, that we pay it forward and making life easier. If the leaders of the world, right, have that respect, the decisions would be so different in our world, right?
Yeah.
Thank you for that. This has been so great. I so appreciate your honesty. I so appreciate you, like, giving us a window into how you do this thing. And I'm just going to ask you, I mean, you've kind of said this already. If there was one thing you would like our viewers watching to action today, what would that be? That you think will make the biggest difference for themselves and their families?
I've got one.
Okay.
If you screw up with your child, go and make it right with them by apologizing. Go and repair each of those breaks. Mm-hmm. When your conscience tells you that you got upset a little too much, you lost it, you were being manipulative, you were being unfair, just go back to your child afterwards and say, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And make sure that it's a good time for them. You know, if they're like, you know, no dad, I'm playing or whatever, say, okay, that's great. You know, come talk to me when you have a moment, or ask mm-hmm. them again. And when it's a good time for them, they say, yeah, that's fine. You say, I'm sorry for getting upset at you earlier. Mm-hmm. Don't explain it away. And don't say like, I'm sorry, I had a bad day and blah, blah, blah.
There's no buts. There's no,
I'm sorry that I got upset at you and I'm not going to do that anymore. You know,
and
whatever.
Maybe even asking how it felt, like, so they can express mm-hmm. it or something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, you can go deeper with this one, but there's mm-hmm. there's a, hey, I got that was something that's not okay to do, and I'm sorry, you know. And if you can't say I'm not going to do that anymore, at least say I'm going to work on that. I'm going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, and yeah. really mean it, you know, and make sure that they see that, and because the. You don't have to, one of our teachers taught us, you don't have to get this right all the time. I mean, if you just do this, you know, 20 or 30% of the time, it makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm. But then you're also modeling that we make mistakes and that we can own them. And we
clean them up.
We clean up after ourselves. And there's so much forgiveness, right?
Yeah, I want to be clear that we don't ask the child to forgive. Unless
no, but they automatically, they're automatically a yes to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I wouldn't ask the child to do it to alleviate our guilt, though I want to make sure that that's a distinction.
Okay, fair enough.
My one thing would be to fall in love with your life. Systematically find ways to fall in love with your life so that your child sees you modeling relationship to life is being in love with your life.
Mm.
Because you're raising a child to copy how you relate to life, and they're watching how you relate to life. So first, create a life that you love. Make it very transparent that you love it to your child. And then they will copy that. And I think that's the greatest gift a parent can give to a child. Mm-hmm. I remember hearing once the role of a mother is to show their child what a happy woman looks like. I don't know if it's happy, but alive and triumphantly alive. The role of a mother is to show their child what a triumphantly alive woman looks like. And so mm-hmm. there's work to get to there. And that's kind of what I do privately with my work with women. But yeah, fall in love with your life so your kids can follow.
I think that's your profound statement. That is fantastic. Fantastic. Are there any other profound statements that you would want to leave us with today? There's been a few in this conversation, but I'm leaving it open. If there's anything else you would want to share, what's your most profound statement in this moment?
I mean, the one I teach my clients and that I work on in my personal relationships is you love me. I think everyone's nailed, I love you. We've heard it a million times. It's a cliche. Not many people hear from people that they love, oh, you just brought me a cup of tea unsolicited. You love me. Mm. Oh, I saw that you remembered this, that you did this on Wednesday and you came and dropped it off. I can tell that you love me. I feel it. Because when we love people all the time, we're smuggling our love in all these tiny little ways, in subtle ways that we never get sign off on the FedEx package that I love you landed in their reality and in their consciousness. So when you say to someone you love, you love me. I see it. And then make a specific instantiated example of how you see it or feel it. They get to feel like, oh, sign off on the FedEx package. It got delivered. My I love yous. And so looking for opportunities to notice the people in your life, how they're loving you and saying to them, I see it, you love me, I think is a game changer.
It's a wonderful practice. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. And Evan, any from anything that comes to mind, I'll give you a chance.
Yeah. You know, it's actualize yourself and your potential and have your child grow up watching a human being who is becoming their greatest self. Go learn about your personality type. Take some personality type tests. Take a few different ones. You know, take the love language one. Take a Myers-Briggs. Take an Enneagram. Take a Big Five. You know, get into some of these and get some mirrors and learn about what your natural kind of gifts are. And then go out into the world and learn new skills. Develop yourself. Become greater. Make more value for other people. Be a better contribution. Build relationships with different types of people and grow into your best self, and then have your child kind of catch you doing that once in a while. And when they say, hey, what are you doing? You explain to them how you're taking some part of your potential and you're doing something with it. You're following a passion. You're doing a hobby. Show them that you're doing that. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is you'll build a human that's what the natural thing is to do, is to figure out what you're good at and what you're here to do, and then to go do it.
I mean, literally, he just published a book that I've been working on it for a year, and she watched him writing it. She watched it get published and the box show up, and she's like, my dad writes books. And so one day she's just, I'm writing a book, and she's sitting there thinking about what's going to be on the cover of my book. And she's already got that frame. I'm that's writing books. And I mean, I didn't get that.
And I didn't teach it to her. I didn't sit down and say, like, this is what we do.
Yeah.
I was doing it all the time. And then all of a sudden the book showed up, and then she's like, oh, I'm going to write a book. So yeah, my statement is actualize yourself and then have your child catch you doing it.
Okay. I love that. Oh my goodness. Annie and Evan, this has been so, so great. Such a great interview. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your wisdom with us, the things that you've learned, the things that you're working on, and all the nitty gritty of how it happens. It's been amazing. And you know what? And thank you for all the work you do also as leaders in your own right out in the world, helping other people learn how to become their best selves and make this a more mindful world. Thank you so much.